Accession number 30493, Reel 9.
Well, before we come on to that, I'm just staying with Egypt for a while.
Sorry?
Staying with Egypt. How much contact did you have with the Egyptian population?
Nil. This is a terrible thing to have to say, really. But of course, this process of, I mean, here they are, 2022, and I was growing up, wasn't I? Really, in the early 20s, I was discovering what people were like, what the world was like, what other people were like, and. The attitude of the army to the Arab peoples was beastly. The terrible thing is that it's the only time, is one instance in my diaries where I used the word wog. Now, why did I use that word, wog? I was just a greenhorn, you know. And suddenly everybody was talking about wogs, so, you know, it's there in my diary. But then I think I became aware of this, the racism of it, you know, and what the contempt and the lack of understanding, the ignorance that lay behind that word. It comes out gradually in my diaries, you know. Because they were distant, they were just distant from us, you know, we just saw them. They're all desperately poor, you see. I mean, we never saw poverty. I mean, no matter how poverty-stricken the English were, the British in the 1930s, the poverty you saw in the Middle East was something, you know, they were sort of the other out there, and there they were in their Arab dresses, but not all of them. Western dress. I mean, we didn't meet cultivated Egyptians, obviously. We just saw the wogs on the street. And there was this horrible talk about if you knock a wog down with your vehicle, you go back and you run over him again to make sure he's dead. Now, I've heard that in the army. Isn't it shameful to have to say it? But there we are, I'm trying to be truthful all the time. It's upsetting. But cured me of racism, I can tell you. I mean, the next cure was in my diary when we were in Palestine. I say, at some point, I say, now we're in Palestine and we see all the Jews around us and what they've done here in Tel Aviv, all those horrible stories we used to hear about Jews, you know, are just made to be ridiculous. So there's a sudden awakening, you know, this anti-Semitism, you know, racism that's current in Britain. You can't imagine that educated, cultivated people were anti-Semitic, sort of automatically in Britain. It's not, I mean, it wasn't just ignorant people at the bottom, it was ignorant people way up to the top. And there are these awful reports that came to light when these secret documents were released every 30 years, where there are comments on official documents which are totally racist and anti-Semitic. I mean, there were the reports of Nazi atrocities against Jews, the treatment of Jews. I mean, that was accepted, you see, in the appeasement days. Though, you know, Hitler didn't like the Jews and they were beginning to smash their shops up and burn their synagogues. Well, you know, we don't like Jews very much either. It's not explicit, it's just there. I mean, it's there in government documents, Foreign Office documents. I mean, Jewish scholars, Israeli scholars, have written books about this underlying Semitism, which prevented the West doing anything about the persecution of the Jews. I mean, we didn't attempt to bomb the camps, you see, and things like that. We didn't. We pretended, well, we perhaps to some extent we didn't know about one, you see. I've got one or two stories that sort of back that up. The officer class, who almost to a man would have voted for Neville Chamberlain and Peasant, they probably all read the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail, which is such a right-wing paper, totally for Hitler for years. One thing leads to another, you see, when you get on to racism. There it is, the racism I learned about were the army calling the Arabs wogs in Cairo, and then the anti being cured of any anti-Semitic prejudice when I was in Palestine. Although, you see, in the diary somewhere I say riots in Tel Aviv. We are alerted because there was an element among the Jews in Palestine who were prepared to go on killing us. They had been the Stern gang who believed in violence to create a free Jewish Palestine. I'm not sure how what point Israel comes into all this. But there are, one thing leads to another, only connect, you see, the enforcer said, only connect. And I did a lot of connecting for those years, I can tell you.
You moved to Palestine directly after Egypt?
We moved all over the place, and sometimes we were split up. The regiment, half the regiment went off and began to have invasion exercises, perhaps in Syria. You see, the whole sort of Middle East, from Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, that all became a sort of enormous training ground. I mean, there were troops from every... extraordinary. I mean, I dip into the diaries, I'm amazed at the variety of troops. You see, we had to go into Syria to crush the Vichy French regime there, and the same in Lebanon. Beirut, in the early years, just the beginning of the war, where in France collapse, there was the French colonials all over the world, Vietnam and Middle East, they thought they could go on being Vichy French, for France, but not against Hitler. I mean, peace with Hitler and everything for France. These were the French right wing and the out-and-out fascists who took over and cooperated with Hitler. In fact, in France, the Vichy French went rounding up more Jews than the Germans did. It's such a shameful period, French history. Shameful. There's always immense literature on all these events now, totally reported and secret documents published. It's a terrible, terrible story. But incredibly interesting if anybody wants to get into it. So there we are, yes, Egypt, Palestine. I mean, Palestine, I managed to get to all the famous places, the holy places, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Gethsemane. It was marvellous, actually, there again with my camera, you see, to clamber up this hill opposite Jerusalem, and there's the wall going round Jerusalem, and I'm in Gethsemane, apparently, you know, and I think, oh, Jesus Christ, I'm supposed to walk here, you know, and I got a lovely photo just of two goats on this mountainside, relaxing among the rocks, which sort of sum up my visit to Gethsemane. So marvellous opportunity, swimming in the Dead Sea. It's extraordinary how much leisure we were able to get, really. But, you know, you didn't... We were able to... lots of... But I say, we were very welcome in Palestine. The Jewish groups laid on all kinds of welcoming places with cheap food. Food becomes very important, my diaries. I describe in detail. The army food was so monotonous that, you know, anything extra or tasty or variety, it was a subject of reportage in my diary.
What was the standard? What were the standard army rations?
Well, they're okay. All I can say is they were monotonous. You know, basically, the trouble is all the vegetables were I forgot what they call it now, powdered. You know, potatoes, carrots, they all came in. They were all sort of, I can't think of the technical word for it. They were processed and became a sort of powder. And they always had the same taste of having been processed in some way. So whenever we got fresh vegetables, that was really something, you know. And happily in the Middle East, vegetables began to be part of our diet. That's all I could say, really. There were big breakfasts available. I mean, they catered for the English in... obsession with all-day breakfasts. So you get your bacon, eggs and toast and sausage from an unlikely source, shall we say. Food was so important, really, when I come to think of it. And those cooks, so the way they had hot meals for us under all conditions, you know, they're another forgotten aspect of the army. The way they could do it, you know. I mean, we might complain about the bloody cook and his products, but there they were, three hot meals a day, really. Amazing when you can't think of it. Up there in the mountains or out there in the desert, and there was this hot food. I mean, without it, it'd be a mutiny, of course. The troops had to be fed. Vital. All little aspects of the war that really are don't go into the history books.
How much were you aware of the general political and religious tensions and issues while you were in Palestine?
Well, you see, they hit you pretty solidly. I mean, now you see, let me just read a little bit here. You develop, this is the beginning of a sort of callous attitude to death. I'm in Cyprus in 1943 on a Sunday, July the 25th, 1943. News this morning is that Chalky, he'd been called Chalky because he was the had whitish complexion as nicknames. Chalky and Davidson, with whom I travelled to Nicosia yesterday, have run their heads into trouble, with the result that Chalky has died of knife wounds and Davidson is in hospital. No facts available yet. That we stand by for a funeral party. My reactions? Few. Chalky was an elderly chap whose lifetime has been spent almost entirely on boozy and light pursuits. His only virtue, a sense of humour, which enabled him to be on excellent terms with most Cypriots. But he's always looked for trouble. Now he's had it, I'm afraid. It's sort of a callous comment, isn't it, somebody? But there we are. You see, you were likely to get knifed in Cyprus. They're always, in these countries, there's always a minority who hated you. I mean, usually for good reason. But they are the ones who didn't just want change. They thought if they had an opportunity, they wanted to kill you. And that was a tiny minority in Cyprus, who later on, of course, I've forgotten the political term for that group in Cyprus. But of course, so it's interesting, you see, that the knifing of us, in a few of us, there again, you see, a lot of troops laid themselves wide open to incidents like that. When they got pissed, they would start, abusing the locals. I mean, it happens today, doesn't it? We've got a penchant, haven't we, the English, for getting into trouble when we get drunk, It's happening in the papers every day, isn't it? Look at these football matches coming up. Whole armies of police have to be produced, to stop them killing each other. And so it's no surprise that British troops were in punch-ups, or they insulted women. And, the male attitude in the Middle East to their women was, you touch that woman, you're dead, So this minority of Cypriots wanted freedom for Cyprus, and all the Cypriots did, actually. But happily, most of them wanted us to fight Hitler first. They're sensible enough to think, to realise they won't get their freedom under Hitler, and we were there to defend them, really, in the long run. So, as a result, there was a very valuable unit of the Cypriot. They had mule. They were the ones who knew how to handle mules, and there was a separate unit in Italy. Really valuable service. But of course, they got their army training, and then when they were demobbed in Cyprus, then they began to fight for Cypriot freedom, and it's a big history of struggle. They were labelled terrorists, of course, automatically, but eventually these terrorists reached agreement, and the chief terrorist, who was Bishop Macarius, was made welcome at 10 Downing Street. What a familiar story that is. How many terrorists do you think have gone through the front door of 10 Downing Street? A great many, I can tell you. Kenyatta, Nkrumah, Mandela, terrorist number one in South Africa, now is a world hero. Time teaches you to be rather cynical about newspaper headlines and labels, sticking labels on people. So this all stems from, my experience of British troops getting into trouble. Now in Cyprus, there again, you see, guys would be coming, they'd just be knifed outside the local wine bar. And so I could talk with them. And the diaries got quite a few war stories from different chaps who were fellow patients for 6 weeks in the Nicosia hospital. An interesting time.
Did the army take any effort to inform the troops about the cultural differences?
I remember there were sort of handouts. The ABCA, Army Bureau of Current Affairs, they usually issued a pamphlet of some kind introducing you to the American Army and its ways. And similar. I'm not sure how much of that I saw, frankly. I'm very aware of that literature now. As a bookseller, it just all passed through my hands all over again. But at the time, I'm not sure how much I saw. Not many references to Abka, but I think a very important role they played, no doubt about it. Very important.
What effect on your views about British imperialism and colonialism did your time in the Middle East have?
Well, I was pretty ignorant when I entered the army, you know. I just had a teenage self-involvement, you might say. The world didn't really exist, I don't, for me then. Does it exist for teenagers ever? I don't think so, really. So my education began the moment I put a uniform on. It's just meeting so many guys you never have met in your civilian life. And the first bloke to put me right, shall we say, or put me left, would be better. I report him as a red-hot socialist. He was only with us for a few days. It was in the same billet. We were out in Nottingham delivering coal and collecting paper. And I remember having one or two arguments with him. Now, my attitude, having sort of volunteered, was, you know, oh, we've got to defend your country and blah, 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 blah. And he just laughed at me. And mother, I was rather sort of shocked at his left-wing views. But that was certainly the beginning of seeing the world critically and trying to understand modern history, just the beginning of it. I realised how ignorant I was. That's the important thing, isn't it? Unless you realise how ignorant you are, you're not going to get anywhere. I was massively ignorant, and no doubt about it, the war hastened my education. So it's so. And there we are. And then from then on, it was what I saw with my own eyes. I didn't have to wait anybody to tell me about. We behaved, you see, like the war with the white race in uniform. We were an imperialist army, you know. So through the war years, we gradually became, I think, a democratic army. But very slowly, I think the army educated itself on the whole pretty well during those years of war. I used to talk politics with the lads, and gradually, I had this flow of literature from these very nice people in Britain who decided I was going to be their wartime pen friend. And certainly two of them were left-wing, and sent me this stream of books and propaganda. I suppose you tell me propaganda. I don't mean that in a bad sense. It was good information. And I discovered about the appeasement of Hitler and the terrible inequality in the 30s, you know. I learned, and of course, suddenly this woman in Hampstead began to send me Left Book Club books. Now, did you dip into that book? You didn't know about Left Book Club, did you? No, a lot of, I mean, and yet, and all the social historians, you'll find that somewhere there's a mention. It pops up all over the time. It was in the paper the other day, in an article. If you keep your eyes and ears open, you'll hear Left Book Club, and people were influenced by it. I mean, the whole generation of actors, you see, who would have been members of the Left Book Club, and they went into, as amateur actors, they went to a theatre called Unity Theatre in North London. And I talked a lot about that in this theatre talk I recorded for the British Library. And then a book's just been published, and there's another one there on theatre workshop. And all these people, they sprung from the depression and the war of the 30s and 40s. You couldn't help but be shaped by it, that. And leading actors today, they began in Unity and in Left Wing Theatre. And they've never forgotten those years. And I think it's Left Wing today now, as they were when during their youth in the war. You can't forget that image of an unnecessary World War II. We could have stopped Hitler. Of course we could. If we'd been angry about him supporting Franco in the Spanish Civil War, marching into Austria, marching into Czechoslovakia, nothing done about it. Chamberlain coming back, waving his stupid bit of paper. Peace in our time. And the British people fell for it, a large percentage of them. That's all seared into the memory of people, my generation anyway. But we shouldn't forget it. We appeased Hitler year after year. Helped him. The banks helped him. We helped the Japanese fascists. Where did they get all the steel and iron? They weren't a steel-producing country. All the steel and the iron came from the West. Boosted, made the tanks and the guns that were later to kill the Allies, slaughter the Allies. Only connect one bit of history with another. Vital to understanding. I'm rabbiting on, but there are, you're letting me do it.
Were things like the Left Wing Book Club and left wing views and socialist views fairly prevalent among the troops that you were saying?
Well, you know, there's such a thing as folk memory, you know. It's a general sort of a cynicism. I'm not quite sure what it's cynicism, it's a sort of. Just a general distrust. After all, you know, generations and generations of working people, they had no representative, nobody to talk to them. I mean, generation after generation is a story of exploitation. And if you were right at the bottom and exploited, you were denied education, decent housing, decent way of life, decent food, decent clothing. It's a story of deprivation, and of course, they don't want to teach that in the schools, so people don't know about those years. I mean, there's enough of it today still. It's hidden, but it's there on a terrible scale. We keep talking about making sure that children aren't deprived, but they are. What was it like in the 30s, you know, and earlier? Well, you know, when workers got together to try to defend their own interests, they were rounded up and sent off to Australia, to penal settlements. We shipped off the early trade unionists, you know. Oh, that's terrible that history isn't taught in schools. The reality of it all. But the working guy, he didn't have to be taught it. He lived in his mother and father have also been hungry and struggling all their lives, and they're all in fifth-rate accommodation, back-to-backs. All those back-to-backs were still there, you see, right at the end of the war. So a Labour government at least swept away the back-to-backs, but then they put up these awful housing estates, which just sort of perpetuate this isolation of deprived people. It goes on and on.